Ready to go? I'm Jonathan Oxhorn, a professor emeritus in architecture and the speaker of this august body. We start with a land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayukono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayukono are members of a Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayukono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayukono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. The meeting is called to order. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from the February 15th, 2023 meeting by unanimous consent. This is minutes that have been posted verbatim online. If there are any corrections, I think they would be in the form of typos. Please just bring them to the attention of the Dean of Faculty. And we will move on to the next order of business, which is a introduction presentation of the Cornell University Library. Elaine Westbrooks is the university librarian. That's 5 minutes.
Thank you. As been indicated, my name is Elaine Westbrooks. I'm the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian, and I've been at Cornell for about 8 months. And I'm a boomerang. I used to be here 15 years ago, and I came back for the lovely weather that we have here in Ithaca. Next slide, please. So I want to give you a really quick overview of what the core principles and the things that libraries do. The first thing is that we preserve history and culture for future generations, particularly Cornell University history and culture. Next slide. Okay, this is just the handwriting of Ezra Cornell. You often hear any person, any study. The reason we know that is because of Cornell archives. And it's our job to preserve what Ezra Cornell actually said. And we have lots of wonderful things he said other than any person, any study. Next slide, please. The second thing we do is we build the collections for future generations of scholars, not just for scholars today, but scholars for future generations. And this is an important part of our mission. This is what most people expect libraries to do. Next slide. One of the ways this is manifested in is our collection of journals and databases that we license for the entire campus. And this is something we're gonna talk about in the second part of my presentation. Next slide. Here's an example of one of our amazing collections. This is from our persuasive maps collection. And I think this is from roughly 1919. And this is a map about women suffrage. And again, just like it sounds, it's a collection designed to persuade the readers. Next slide. The third thing we do is we teach and facilitate scholarship with a variety of services, but we create services that are not available anywhere else in the university. Next slide. This is an example of one of the services that I think is one of our most impressive. We call it evidence synthesis, and this is a service that any student, any faculty member, any graduate student can use to better do research. And that means register protocols, that means finding the right articles to do your paper, that means the actual synthesis of the work that you need to write the best possible paper. Next slide, please. The other thing we do is we deliver core literacies. That includes information literacy, so students understand good information from bad information, from misinformation. We also have literacies about data, about media. We have literacies about making. These are things that students do. They do the making. They are engaged in social media. They're engaged in information every day of their lives. And we find that when students come to the library and they learn about these literacies, they learn how to understand information, media, data better. They are better students and better learners. Next slide. We inspire discovery. Next slide. Students come into the library, which I believe are learning centers and student success centers. And I think this is Stephen Beder's public history class, but we have dozens and dozens of students, and each semester or a year, we have hundreds of students that come in to the library to engage with primary resources, secondary resources. But the key part is that they interact with the experts, librarians and staff in the library on a day-to-day basis. Next slide. We are the cornerstone of democracy. It is clear that a democratic society works best when information flows freely. And that's why the fact that the library is a place for pluralism, it's a place where we collect all things for all people, all disciplines, all sides. That is what libraries do. And we have a lot of things that offend a lot of people. And that's, I could find something that offend all of you. That's what libraries do. Next. This is about the information that we provide that is really key to a democratic society. And this is something that's really being challenged right now. And so I really just want to affirm that libraries really are the stewards of facts, and facts are an important part of dialogue in a democratic society. Next slide. Okay, that was really fast. I went through five things that I think were the most important things that university libraries do, particularly Cornell University Library, which is one of the best libraries on the planet. If you have any questions or comments, please come talk to me, Slack me, email me. I'd love to talk to you more. I'm still learning more about the campus. It's changed a lot in 15 years, but the more interaction I have with faculty, students, and staff, the better we are. So I'm gonna invite my colleague, Max. We're gonna do kind of a tag team on this next presentation, but this is, you need to actually set us up for the-
No, I just will remind everyone that you'll have 10 minutes and then there'll be 10 minutes for Q&A afterward. So go right ahead.
Thanks for having us. This committee consists of about, you know, the number have been changing, roughly about 15 members from both the library system side, also on the academic side, right? So by the equal division, sure. So this is the chart we had. I'm not gonna read all those seven charges, but you can see roughly there's four layers, right? The number one is what's the problem with the current model. Current model works fine. We don't need to change anything. Right? The number two and number three is what could be a new model and social challenges with you. And 4-6 is about, under a new model, what are the roles of the different part of the campus, right? So the number seven is about, I think we had to report to the faculty about the immediate, challenge of the for-profit publication entities. If you go to the next slide. Also the title of the committee, they call the future scholarly communication. Right? This is not committee on open access. So that's why the charge here is also, we look at broadly, not just the open access per se, but look broadly the scholarly ecosystem. And the next slide here, I think we'll defer to Lane to talk about the challenge. Right? So, because I have a former position at UNC, we have done a deal a lot.
Thank you. Thanks, Mac. Can you go to the next slide, please? Okay. So when we talk about the real problem that we have, it actually is a wicked problem. And I think when many of us got into our field of study, the world was very different. When journals were prints before the internet existed, when scholarly societies and learned societies were strong, robust institutions. And that is just not the case anymore. And so I put this quote here, which I think lays out the challenge that we have ahead of us. And we are now dealing largely with five multinational companies that control most scholarship in the world. That's Elsevier, Springer, Wiley, Sage, Taylor, and Francis. And some of the STEM areas they control as much as 80%. So this is a problem that definitely keeps me up at night. Next slide, please. So just give you a sense. These numbers need to be checked, but this really gives you a sense of how much money these publishers are making off of the free content that we give them. And just notice Elsevier is, I believe they're actually more than $10 billion. But the reason why they can make $10 billion is because they get their content, the articles that we all publish free. And so I want to be clear that I do not believe that publishers are inherently evil or bad. What I really want to bring home is the fact that this is not good for science, it's not good for scholarship, and it's not good for innovation to have a small set of multinational companies that we call an oligopoly control all of the academic publishing in the world. Next slide. This is an old set of data, but I think it really does demonstrate the problem that I've alluded to at the beginning, which is there used to be a lot more companies and societies that publish journals. And what we're finding is many of them are selling those journals or working directly with Wiley and Springer and Elsevier largely. And when those societies transfer their journals to these big multinational publishers, the cost go up exponentially. And this shift started in the 70s. And this chart stops at 2013, but it's actually gotten much worse. And this is the natural medical sciences. This is also happening in social sciences, and it's happening in the humanities. This is not sustainable. Next slide, please. I wanted to share with you these profit margins. At the top is Elsevier, which is approximately 40% profit margin. We have JP Morgan, we have Apple, we have Amazon. Amazon is 2.3%, right? That's often very surprising. But my whole point is to say that the largest academic publishers are reaping enormous profits from knowledge from which the public largely pays. It's a business model that keeps the knowledge out of the hands of the public. Knowledge is locked behind paywalls, and this is not sustainable for libraries, and it's definitely not sustainable for higher education. The next slide, please. This is another older slide that definitely we need to do research to update this, but this just gives you a sense of the inflation that our publishers inflict annually on the library. And so if we keep the same content, our costs go up almost $1 million a year for the exact same content. And these numbers actually have doubled. Our inflation rate currently is closer to 10% now. And it seems that there's no evidence that that's going to go down. So books inflate, journals inflate, databases inflate, and the library has to manage this year after year. Next slide. So let's just talk about the labor, right? This is a gift economy. And if you work your way from left to right at the bottom, it shows you who the work that has to get done, who pays for it, and who does the work. And if you'll follow this from left to right, you'll see that in most cases, it's either the research and the funder, it's the researcher or the university. There's only one case where the publisher is really doing a lot of the work, and that's the actual publishing. Our faculty and researchers do the quality control called peer review. We produce the content, and we also consume the content. And so this is a gift economy. Where the taxpayers are funding the National Science Foundation and NIH. And this is one of the reasons why Elsevier can make a 40% profit margin, because they do not have to pay for the content that they sell. And so this is a system that is, I believe, very inequitable. It's unsustainable. It's opaque. How they come to the prices for journals is not transparent or clear. And the fact that many of us have been signing non-disclosure agreements when we sign these licenses with publishers. That's been happening for many years. Thank goodness Cornell University Library stopped signing non-disclosure agreements decades ago, but many libraries do. And so it's very hard to bargain when we don't know what each other is paying for the different prices of journals and databases. Next slide. So here are the recommendations. I'll invite Max back. And if you read the report, we just want to say that the report attempts to go through that charge that Max showed at the beginning. The charge was kind of impossible. It was very ambitious. And I think the committee, of course, worked through the pandemic. And then there were a lot of transitions in the library. And so this committee was actually put together in 2019. And we just now wrapped up the report in 2022 at the end of last year. And so the two key parts in the summary of this report focus on these areas. And I'm committed as the university librarian that the library will do two things. We want to invest in these projects and initiatives that move scholarly communications in a way that is more sustainable, equitable, and open. And then we are also planning to launch a campaign to build awareness across campus. I would say that the challenges and the issues that go into the economics of scholarly publishing, how it works, who pays for what, is very difficult for a lot of people to understand. I actually think about this every day, in the morning and at night. I think about this a lot. But I think we definitely need to do some awareness building across campus. I think graduate students need to understand how the system is working, and more importantly, how it's not working for us as a society. I believe that Cornell should be the place that finds a solution, that we should be the leader. If we can't figure this out at Cornell, I don't know if anybody's going to be able to figure this out. And so one thing I could say is all libraries are talking to each other. We are all part of buying clubs and consortia that we participate in to lower the costs, to get better deals on the cost of journals and databases. We talk about this every day. This is a longstanding problem. And so there is a lot of will and effort within the library community to address this problem. And I think the challenge is that Cornell University Library cannot fix this problem by ourselves, and Cornell University can't fix this problem. So we have to step up. And as a library, I'm committed to disrupting the system, finding a way to build a better system that I think is better for all of us. And so I'm going to hand off the next slide to Max, because he's going to talk about what the faculty, what the report recommends that faculty can do to help.
I think on the faculty side, I think this awareness campaign, and we have to be a part of it, right? So, and no sugarcoating, most of the researchers don't care at least right now, right? And how we can make this, you know, how can empower the researcher, you know, understanding the social, economical, and even ethical context of this, of those challenges, right? And also, and understand our rights. You know, I'm typically my goal is to sign off all the copyright agreement as soon as possible to get my paper published. Right? So, but at the same time, we have rights, right? How we can utilize our rights for good, for the better society. I think that's a part of it. Thank you.
Thanks. We have time for some questions. If you're here in person, just come down to either of these microphones. If you are online in Zoom, raise your digital hand. And we can do this for the next 8 or 9 minutes. While we're waiting, if you wanted to have more comments, I know I rushed you a little bit, since there's nobody raising their hand that I see. They're not in the chat. They're going to raise their hand.
Well, I have something to add. Well, I know many of you might be aware of the mandates that are coming from NIH, mm-hmm. the Office of Science and Technology, from the White House. The challenges that I'm seeing is that there's been a shift where now researchers are being expected to pay article processing fees and charges to make your papers open access. And it's good that information is open. When information is open, it's more likely to be cited. And when it's more likely to be cited, it's more read. I think that's a good thing. The challenge is the economics. I don't know if it makes sense for the library to pay for these subscriptions, the millions of dollars we spend a year, and the research to also pay thousands of dollars for these APC costs. There are cases where we could split it, but this is the model that's emerging in Europe and the United States. And I think we have to be careful about the unintended consequences of that model.
We do have a question or comment from Debbie Turney online. Go ahead, unmute yourself.
Okay. How, as individual researchers, I mean, some of these are costing $3,000 or $4,000 to get the work out. And I know, like you said, some of our societies are going to these big publishing companies. How are we as individual researchers, can we help? I mean, what do you think we're supposed to do to keep this down?
Thank you for that question. There are many things you could do. I think the first thing that puts us at a disadvantage is that, as Max indicated, most of us sign away our intellectual property to the publisher. So the first thing is retain your copyright. When you get that form, when you get your article accepted, read the form. And if you want to talk to a librarian about that form, we'd love to talk to you more about it. But that form gives you the most restricted license. And what you can say is, actually, I want to own the copyright. So no, thank you. Can you give me the other form where I could keep my copyright? And we can help you in that process. Second thing you could do is, if you're on your publications committee of your scholarly or learned society, really try to understand the economics of that journal you're publishing and understand the motivations. And if you have questions, and I know it's going to sound like every response is talk to a librarian, but I actually think you should talk to a librarian, because we have been working on flipping journals to find ways to, from a journal that's built for profit, to flip the journal so that it is freely available to everyone. And so the more you can learn about the economics of the journal of your society, the better off you're going to be. I promise you, Wiley is going to come, offer you oodles of money, but they're not going to talk to you about the consequences of when you switch from a learned society to a Wiley or a Springer to publish that journal.
We have another question or comment from Paul Ginsberg. Unmute yourself.
Thank you. I wanted to bring some historical perspective to this, because I was paid attention to your comment that if we can't solve this at Cornell, nobody can. I served on the library board from roughly 2002 to 2010, starting under Sarah Thomas, and then she left in 2007, and the next university librarian was Ann Kenny. And we discussed this issue at length. In fact, sad to say, many of the slides we presented were basically identical. I mean, the same themes. It's sort of remarkable how little has changed, except, of course, the numbers have scaled up by some factor, but, you know, there's still the Elsevier and all of the rest. Under the library board, we made a proposal to the faculty senate about only submitting to open access journals or not signing. It passed the faculty senate. I believe that was in the 2007 timeframe. At roughly the same time, the European libraries and science societies made proposals that publishers would have to have the hybrid model, where they permitted people to pay a little extra to get articles open access. And the publishers, Elsevier included or especially, really loved this, because they realized they could now double their revenues, getting both, you know, article fees as well as the usual subscription revenue. So my question is, and you know, I don't have a I don't have any prescriptive actions in mind, but I just want to register my concern that, you know, we've given it all of that thought, evidently without success. Every other university in the country is doing that. We even had the question of these non-disclosure agreements and the big deal and all of that. And so I would just urge a note of caution that it's going to be very, very difficult because many people have been thinking about this simultaneously and not come up with an alternative. My alternative, of course, was just to bypass the journals entirely, but you know, that's a different system that might not work for everyone.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate those comments. And you're absolutely right. We have not moved the needle as much as I would have liked since 2002. But what I can say is that I believe the library took a much more bold stance in the early 2000s, and then we went away from that. And I'd like to bring us back to that bold stance where we are coming up with principles. We are very much focused on changing the way we build collections because of the circumstances of publishing today. What I do think is different now than it was 20 years ago or 15 years ago is we have the University of California system, which has really taken a move to shift who pays for the journals. And that does not necessarily disrupt the system, but that is a new model that we're looking at right now. The other part I'd like to say is the preprint servers like Archive, which of course Paul Ginsberg was instrumental in making, are another venue and that we support, that preprint servers are a really important way to speed up science, to preserve knowledge, and to share it more freely. And so once we start talking about open access, preprint servers, read and publish, transformative agreements, there's all these things that are happening right now, and it's just really complicated and complex. But I would like the opportunity to come back once the library has our task force formed and we start planning for what this looks like. And I also would love to engage in another dialogue. I mean, Paul, you're really putting out a pretty realistic viewpoint that this is really tough, but
also I want to emphasize, I would be the first one to be absolutely thrilled if you succeed where the rest of us have failed.
I appreciate that because I just can't sit back and watch this happening. I mean, we've been talking about this as a profession for 25 years. And I just cannot sit back and say, oh, well, like, you know, I guess we'll just keep giving $2.8 million to Elsevier. And we'll just keep spending this money and then engaging in a conversation with you about what we're going to cut, which is not the conversation I want to have with faculty. But that's the reality of our situation. So I would just really want to engage in a dialogue. And if you have some ideas, please contact me. If you're interested in sharing some of your perspectives, I think one of the big parts is there's just disciplinary differences. And we know that you cannot treat econ the same that you treat chemistry and literatures and English, and disciplinary differences are important. And so I don't want to suggest that there's one solution that's going to solve all the disciplinary problems or that there's one solution that's going to disrupt the system. All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think we need to move on. Thank you very much. We now have Alan Matthews, Presidential Task Force on Admissions.
Always got to lower it.
Let me just say there's 5 minutes for your presentation, and then we'll have some 10 minutes for Q&A, faculty discussion.
I'm really pleased to be here to update the Faculty Senate on our Presidential Task Force on Undergraduate Admissions. Next slide. The three co-chairs of the task force are Avery August, Kelly Cunningham, who's chief of staff for in Martha's office, and then Patricia McBride. And then the faculty that are on this committee, there's, next slide is, there's 9 faculty. So this is a very faculty-driven approach to trying to help the university think through how we can admit a diverse class that meets our mission, okay? So the task force charge, next slide, is first, one of the things we should always have an obligation to do is look at our admissions processes, make sure they're consistent with the legal framework that we're operating in, but also always trying to tie our admissions processes again to our broader mission. And so that's sort of how we're thinking about what this task force is about. And then the next slide is the actual charge. This was published in the Cornell Chronicle and widely distributed, this charge. So it's a little wordy. And I didn't put the whole charge. This is sort of a preamble charge. And it talks about 2 major components of what our task force is about. First, coming up with what's called a university-wide admissions policy. And so if you go to that website and at your leisure, here are the major components of what we mean by admissions policy, a university-wide admissions policy. First, it embodies Cornell's founding principle and its core values. It responds to the current legal and demographic landscapes. It advances compliance with applicable accreditation standards and inspires admitting units, colleges, to recruit a class of the appropriate size that is diverse across a range of different categories and that exhibits excellence across an equivalently diverse range of students. Okay. On the principles of practice, which is more like the implementation side of this, it includes examining pipelines and pathways to college and recruitment and retention strategies, recommend implementation priorities and assessment mechanisms that are tailored for the residential undergraduate experience, and then to provide to admitting units on ways to effectively identify attributes and experiences of applicants that have prepared them to succeed in the university's academically rigorous programs, positively contribute to the campus community, and exhibit the potential to use their Cornell education to address the most challenging problems of society and the world. Okay, so how we're proceeding, next slide, is we formed 3 subcommittees. And when and this is important because as we ask for broad faculty input into the process, we like that input to sort of focus on what we're trying to gather data on. And so these are the 3 subcommittees. You can just look at them. And one is about applicant characteristics. So what characteristics or indicators should be prioritized, basically? How do we think about that? How do we formulate that in systematic way? This notion of given the large number of applications, they keep going up. Can we use modern technology and machine learning to better think about how we can craft our class? And then on the 3rd committee, really think carefully about how we develop pipelines to high schools, where in that pipeline we should be. Is it just going after trying to communicate with juniors? Should we do earlier? These types of questions are how do we develop the pipeline issues to get the applicants that we want so we can, at selection time, meet our mission. Okay, next slide. So here's what we're doing. We're meeting. We're very early in this process in terms of we're collecting lots of feedback. We're gathering, we're talking to the admissions officials in each of the colleges to try to understand what we're doing currently and to go deep into that. We've had external experts, academic experts, faculty from in areas of economics, sociology, education to help us learn about the current literature on admission issues and admission policies. And we are really wanting to now broaden the input we get. And so this is one of the purposes of updating the Faculty Senate is around those three subcommittees. If you have ideas and want to provide input to us, the web, the email address is there for you. And if you, even best if you direct which subcommittee you'd like it to go. We meet as subcommittees and then we meet as a whole group and report to each other. And again, we're at the very beginning stage of collecting the input. We're not even close to having any recommendations. So this is really a update. Just it's mostly focused on the process at this point. Okay.
Thank you. We have about eight or so minutes for questions or comments. Again, if you're online, raise your digital hand. Okay, I see David Lee. Try to keep it to 2 minutes or so.
Thank you, Alan, and good luck in your committee's work. I had a question, which is as I recall, 3 or 4 years ago, there was another committee that looked at many of the same questions. And it was largely a sort of a visionary and historical report they issued. I haven't looked at it for a while, but as I recall, it's more big picture, more visionary. My question is, how deep are you going to get into the weeds? There are at least three current issues, very specific questions that are being looked at among our peer universities and nationally. One is legacy, how to treat legacy admissions. The second is how to treat the use of the SAT in admissions. And the third is this whole growing area of AI, using AI, I suppose, from the student standpoint to write their admissions essays, and from the university standpoint to evaluate their essays and so forth. Basically, to use AI in holistic review. And I know there's an emerging literature on that. So my question is, how deeply are you going to get into those types of specific issues? Thank you.
Yeah, I think the charge is very broad that we have. And so we are really looking at virtually all aspects of this. And this will include discussions of test scores, legacy, all of those things are up for discussion. And so given how broad it is, how deep we go into any one of them we're going to do our best to collect the most relevant evidence that's out there. Most of our meetings so far have been outside people coming in to sort of educate us about this current state of what they're doing. We've had people from other universities talk about what they're doing, things like that. So I think everything's on the table at some sense. I think that's the best way to sort of give you the answer for that.
So do you anticipate, to quick follow up if I can, do you anticipate that there will be recommendations specifically regarding those three issues, possibly specific recommendations?
I think it's too early to tell exactly what our recommendations will. We haven't even gotten to the point of getting close to recommendations, so I can't say that yes or no. I would say those are not off the table. So it's too early to really tell.
Okay, thank you.
Richard Bensel.
Yeah, thanks for the report. I have a question that I've posed maybe 4 or 5 times in the last decade, which is the relationship between admission of students from abroad and domestic students. My understanding is that students from abroad are given much less likely to be given full support or scholarship support than domestic students, and that the system has been arranged in such a way that foreign students and foreign admissions have basically subsidized the scholarship grants to domestic students. But I have been unable to get a straight answer from the admissions folks. I've posed this question over and over again. So I'd like to add it to David Lee's list of things that should go into the report. Thanks.
Yeah, so I actually, it would be great for you to send that send any comments you have about that. This is not related to the task force, so I'll just give you my personal knowledge. When I was dean about dean of human ecology, again, this is not, we haven't talked about this task force, but I do recall that needs blind admission policies were changed slightly for international students, where we set a budget for how much financial aid that we provided. That was my understanding. We have not focused diversity as international students. Part of the diversity is one of the many, many, many factors that will enter our conversations. Okay.
Any last comments? We have a few minutes only. Okay. Seeing none, I think we'll just move on to the next agenda item. Thank you. Senate announcements and updates. We have Dean of Faculty Eve DeRosa, Chair of the University Faculty Committee, and member of the psychology cohort.
Hey, everyone. this is a reminder for everyone online and everyone in the audience. Please sign in and I'll get started. I'm going to move this so that I can see the slides at the same time. So we had three votes and all of them were approved. And so I'm just going to take you through quickly. I have a little highlight to remember to state that we only had 19 do not votes last year. It was over 40. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let's have it again. I love this level of engagement and thank you very much. The other note to self, and I am now embodying Chelsea. She was frustrated because people weren't really sharing with their constituents. And so please, when we have these discussions, take my Senate summary if you want and share it with your department if you don't get the opportunity to share it in your faculty meetings. There's other ways and other means by which you can share what we're talking about. And hopefully people will see the relevance and importance of what we do here. And of course, please take these votes back after the fact. So we have three resolutions. So resolution 184, this is to ensure academic freedom in the global hubs. And you can see it passed with 64. That's okay. Yeses. And 25 noes and 21 abstains. And then we have now resolution 185. Now we can go. That is our College of Business. They wanted to harmonize their tenure clocks across the different schools. And the choice was to harmonize to the business, to the master's program and PhD program, so the graduate program. And so now it's 8 years for all of the colleges and all the schools inside the College of Business. And that was approved 84 to 15 to 12. And then the last one, 186, and that was to bring a medical gynecologist to the health services at Cornell. And that one received 98 votes for yes, 9, and then 4. So that's all of our votes. Please take them back to your constituents. That would be great. And talking about constituents, our RT faculty have been formally part of the Faculty Senate for the past year, as far as I can appreciate. And so one of the things we did is to make sure they now know who their constituents are. And so everyone's received that. So that means RTE faculty get to also reach out to whomever they're representing, get their feedback before voting. So very pleased to be able to say that. As I've mentioned before, RTE faculty were included, except for the librarians, which we're going to address the next work-life survey. But RTE faculty as a larger group were included in the faculty cohort for the work-life survey. And those data will be coming to me, and so I can sort of parse it by the different types of faculty we have here at Cornell. And then I wanted to say that for the first time, RTE faculty will be included in the faculty SIP, including librarians. So this is also something that I think is another accomplishment as we fully integrate RTE faculty into the Faculty Senate and the university in that way. And I wanted to represent Chelsea again in terms of updating the Senate on nominations and elections. We're getting ready for the spring ballot. And so we are doing really great. So nominations and elections month by month since September has been going by committee, by Senate committee. We have about 13 of them. And looking at the distribution of the different disciplines and also the different colleges and schools. And so we're really trying to have more representation and more diversity and not the same people serving all the time. So you see my pleas in the Monday message every once in a while for people to really contribute outside of their unit. And so the more we do that, I think the more representative we will be and the more engaged people will be. Yes, next slide. I just wanted to share that the provost is having an academic update. We have an opportunity to ask them questions ahead of time and also questions live. And so in response to what was shared, but also if in anticipation you have things that you want them to address or think about, this is our opportunity. And so I just wanted to remind everyone that we have that available to us and that, again, more in a more intimate setting, not a webinar and fully remote, the president will be in the Senate with us next month. So again, if there are topics that you want to see the president address in this space, that it's exclusively important to us, then please email that to the Dean of Faculty email. And I think that's it. Yeah. So I'm open for questions, comments, complaints. So if you're in person, just come to one of the mics because the people on Zoom cannot hear. So.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Heath. So I wanted to note that the Cornell Daily Sun reported on President Pollack's response to the student assemblies support for having a gynecologist hired in the health services, and that that according to the Sun, President Pollack's response was no, that she didn't support doing that, and she thought that there were plenty of non-MDs who could do the work, and that people could go into town to have other treatment. And this really contrasts with the overwhelming support that came through the vote that we just saw. So I have a specific question, which is about, you know, what can be done when we have a very particular situation like this, with this gap between the Senate support, student assembly support, and then the administration's response. You know, what can we do collectively to actually not just say, well, let's move on, but to actually push back? And that's certainly a more general question as well. You know, what can we do collectively to actually move our agenda forward as we have votes?
These are the bits, the ILR. So I can say that obviously all of our feedback will go to the president. And I thank you, Risa, for reminding everyone that this is a resolution, much like the natatorium, which was added to everyone's vocabulary last year, that it went to all of the assemblies and it was approved by all the assemblies. Yet, you know, there isn't necessarily the response that we would hope. And so I do know for the natatorium that there are negotiations, and in particular with Ithaca College, until they find the funds to do so. But for the gynecologist, I've already started speaking with Jada Hamilton, who's the director of the health services. She's wonderful. She's informed. I've invited her to come to the Senate so that we can learn more and be educated about what it is that sort of is the barrier to this being acted upon. And so I think that's one way for us to engage in that way with the director of the health services.
Shall we move on?
Thank you.
We have one more order of business. Cornell Bowers College of Computing and Information Sciences, CIS, resolution to use all ranks of the professor of the practice and research professor titles. The presentation of this resolution will be provided enthusiastically by Charlie Van Loan, Emeritus, Computer Science, CIS, 10 minutes, and then there'll be time for faculty discussion.
Thanks an awful lot, and hi to everybody in the Senate. It's great to see so many old friends. Okay, so we're going to try to get both of these titles on the books, and this presentation is to give you the background information for that. Next slide. So just for your information, many years ago, the Senate created what's called enabling legislation. So if a department, for example, wants to use the professor of practice title, they have to write a proposal, and the enabling legislation gives you a framework for writing that proposal, covering all the important topics. Next slide, please. So we've done this many times before, all right? And for both the POP and the research professor proposals. Just to say up front, we're very interested in feedback for this. And I know there are many RTE senators. If you have insights about these particular titles, please send them. You can click on those links and see how your college went about proposing and getting their titles approved. Next slide, please. So let's talk first about the research proposal, the research professor. There's sort of two main reasons why we're interested in this. First of all, if we manage it properly, we're creating a research-related career path. Okay, and again, if we do that right, it will enhance the stature of the title holder, their department, and the college. Okay, and second, and you see this in all the RP proposals out there, we're behind, all right, and we'd like to compete with our peers in this arena. And many of our peer schools have quite attractive research opportunities off the tenure track. So this is the step towards addressing that. Next slide. So as required, we do internal votes to make sure that the unit in question is on board. These are tentative. It took us a while to get the electorate straight because CIS has lots of joint appointments and 0% appointments and so on. The vote actually closes on Friday, but nevertheless, I think you can see the pattern there that there's almost universal support for this particular title. Next slide. POPs, okay? So the idea behind POP is to bring somebody in who has experience on the outside and can share that experience and teach for us being informed by that experience. So you traditionally might think of maybe someone who's worked in an industry for many years, but you could also someone who's worked for a nonprofit and so on. Is quite a flexible sort of position. But the key thing is that that individual brings in outside knowledge. And that leads to number two there. By having this title, we're sending a signal. And what is that signal? The signal is that we respect knowledge that is acquired outside of academia. And next slide, please. So we also voted for this. And again, you can see quite an overwhelming support for this. But I do want to mention the two people who disapproved of that sent us comments. When we do our ballots in CIS, we also give the faculty the chance to comment. And I just want to say that there are issues in the lecture for lecturers. The lecture track is also a teaching track, obviously. And the question here is that, first of all, the track only has two ranks, and it does not have the word professor in the title. And we have over 300 lecturers on campus. Some of them have given their whole lives to teaching. and doing fantastic jobs. And it was sort of brought to our, you know, I sort of knew this all along that there are issues there with that track, but it sort of surfaced here when we talked about the POP. And I'm really glad that in, I believe, 1 or 2 months, there's going to be a faculty forum where various RT issues are going to be discussed. And I'm going to show up there as a private citizen, at least, and argue for creating a third track there in the lecture in that track, and that it should be titled something like instructional professor. But this is a side topic. It's tangential. I'm just saying that when you put these proposals together, there are often teaching moments that come up along the way. And for me, this was one of them. Next slide, please. So you've seen like over a dozen of presentations of this variety, and I don't want to bore you with the stuff that you've seen before. So let's talk about four things that are a little bit different about our proposals, okay? Just to be honest about the things we're trying to do. Next slide. So first of all, as you know, there's the percent limitation computation that goes into all these proposals, and the enabling legislation puts a limit at 25 and 10 for both of them. And for us, we have quite an operation down at Cornell Tech, and I just want to be clear that the computation involves the sum of faculty here and there. And that all appointments are approved by the CIS dean, Dean Kavita Bala, who I hope is in the audience to answer questions, and also the Cornell Tech dean. So just about how we do that sort of calculation. Just a note there on the percents, the colleges vary in this. First of all, for the RPs, all the colleges go for the 10%. But if you look at the POP percent, engineering, JVSM, I'm not sure how the business college handles this, are at 25%. Human ecology and AAP have 20, Cal's ILR and arts, it's 10. So there's variation there. And again, under the heading of feedback, we've had some concern about the 25%. We're very flexible. We want to hear from people if they think that is out of line or whatever. Next slide. We also have a text in there about statements of contributions to DEI. If you have seen, the OFDB has guidelines about that. Those guidelines apply to tenure track hiring only, okay? And we felt that they should also apply to both POP and RP hiring. And there's a quote from the recommendation from OFDB, which is to say that applicants are invited to comment on that part of their resume. Next slide, please. In fact, the next two slides deal with ranks within these two tracks, because it also brings up very important things. So in particular, the majority of POP appointments on campus and at other universities that we've studied have always been at the full level. When you think about it, you can sort of understand it. We want people who have extensive external experience. And so you come in the door here, it's kind of hard to reason about what would be an assistant POP and how would that person be promoted. We don't slam the door on having assistant and associate POPs. We just feel that most of the time they're going to be appointed at the full level. However, if there is to be an appointment here on campus, there has to be a heightening of that individual's relevant external professional experience. This is a feature that's not explicitly mentioned in any of the other POP proposals that we have seen. So we just want to, again, be up front about that. I think it's very important to state this from the standpoint of how does this track relate to the lecture track, and it's in our proposal. Next slide. There's also a rank issue, well, not issue, a feature about the RP track. Again, it's a three rank track, just like tenure track, okay? And I think the view sort of out there is that, hey, this is the track where we hire superstars and great if you can, and it certainly has happened. However, it does make sense to, when you hire an assistant RT, to really put a lot of value on potential. That's just what we do in the tenure track. So we come out and say that explicitly because I don't think enough attention has been paid to the fact that, again, it's a three-ranked track. We want to have people come and have research careers here. And just a little note there about assistant RPs, that just like for in the tenure track, we value, you know, potential is very important. Now, we do know from the fall, there's discussion about the principal scientist title and perhaps bringing it back. And we're very supportive of that. It does not affect this proposal directly. Okay. This is just like all the previous college RP proposals. And yeah, so that's it. Next slide, which is just the Q&A. And Dean Bala, I believe, is in the room in case you have larger dean-level questions that need to be answered.
So if you're in the room and have any comments or questions, please step up to the microphone. I see a couple of hands. We'll start with Harold Hodes.
Hi, Harold Hodes, philosophy. One thing has puzzled me for quite a while about the very concept of a research professor. What's the point of hiring research professors rather than tenure track professors? It seems that it only increases the amount of teaching that's being done, the amount of intellectual activity on campus that's being done outside of the tenure track. And I'm inclined to think that it's bad to be increasing that. So can you explain to me why it's good?
Sure. Okay, so first of all, in a proper environment, there's interaction between RPs and tenure track faculty. In fact, it's their research project, research activity. It's not like it's a silo. So, and the presence of a great research professor would be to enhance the overall research production in a department, make possible new collaborations and so on. Here's an example, to answer another part of your question, here's an example that we give of someone who might switch from tenure track to RP. Suppose you're an assistant professor, you come in here, you're all enthusiastic, but you discover that you're actually not that interested in teaching. You're not that interested in going through a tenure review. But you have a tremendous research reputation, you're able to bring in external funding, and you decide that that is how I'd like to spend my research life here at Cornell, at least for the next couple of years. So it's whole greater than the sum of the parts if it goes together correctly. And then in no way does it undermine the research activity of the tenure track the faculty.
And I'm just going to jump in, Ms. Kavita Bala. Thanks, Charlie, for doing that. Sorry, I missed the beginning. I think it started a bit earlier than 4:30. In our profession, there are a lot of, if you look at a place like MIT and say CSAIL, is Computer Science and AI Lab, is a peer to us. They have nearly half of their faculty on tenure track and half on research professors. CMU has approximately the same amount. So it is very common among our peers in our business to have a very heavy research professor track. We don't actually have that at Cornell. It's something that it'd be great to have. And actually our location isolates us a little bit, and that has prevented us from having many of them. But it's a vibrant way for people to be involved with academia who don't want to do the teaching. And that's something that we should encourage. And it certainly puts it as a disadvantage to not have.
Who called on the people? Richard?
This is Mark Lewis. I get to go next.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. So Mark Lewis, MORI. My question is, I'm pretty sure that the professor of practice title does not have three ranks in other colleges. And it just seems, I think I heard you say that there's potential of something like that being done in CIS. It just seemed odd to me, for the question and the statement, that we would have some colleges have assistant professor of practice, associate professor of practice, and other colleges not allowing that at all. So do you want to address how it would be different places?
Again, we are not, the audio was a little hard there, but let me hope I get it right. I think you're saying, Mark, that we're not entertaining assistant and associate POPs, whereas some colleges might, and that's a disconnect we don't want to have. We're not slamming the door on that.
Opposite, actually. So, Charlie, the question was, why are we having assistant and associate where other colleges only have one rank?
So, again, we find it very hard to imagine such an appointment at an assistant or associate level, but you never know. So we don't rule it out. But we stay pretty hard there that we anticipate most of the appointments at the full level. At CMU, we looked at a number of other schools. They actually have just the single rank. So anyway, we'd love more feedback on that particular issue if possible.
What I'm trying to say is that there are no such rank in the College of Engineering.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. But there are in the university. They do exist across the university. Yeah.
Okay. I have a couple of people online and also in person. Let me go first to David Delchance, then back here to Risa Leibowitz, and then back online to Doug. And I'm putting Richard last because he already spoke, but you're also in the queue.
My question is very simple. David Delchamps, Electrical Computer Engineering. Charlie, you quoted these stats, percentage of tenure track at the various other positions, and you had this number less than or equal to 25% in the College of Engineering for professors of practice versus tenure track. And in my department, where we have about 40 faculty members, we only have one professor of the practice. Is there any department in engineering that's anywhere near 25%? That seems awfully high to me.
Operations research, to my knowledge, has the biggest POP component on campus. The market can speak to that. Well, if he wants.
I guess he's sitting down. So yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Mark said he has six of them. Five.
Okay. I had no idea that there were that many in any department. Thank you.
Introduce yourself and your department.
It's Risa Leibowitz, ILR. So I always find it kind of curious when one of the arguments that's put forward for having these different titles, professor of fill in the blank, is that it will make us more competitive to have more non-tenure track positions with a title that has professor in it. It seems to me that if we were actually considering competitiveness, we would have more tenure track lines because the job security would be far more attractive to candidates than a position without job security. So I just really find that a very odd kind of thing. And I, you know, like to hear something about it. And if I could kind of pause and then do the follow-up, would that be okay?
I think it's okay.
Sure. Yeah, I can comment on that. In our business, actually, there are people who don't want to teach, but they really want to do research. And the job security is not a big deal because there's just immense amounts of jobs available in industry. So we actually don't have that issue where people feel right now getting people to come into academia at all is really hard in the computing and information space. And they just, you know, they can retire when they're 40 if they go off and work for 15, 20 years. And so they don't think of job security the way people traditionally do when they're thinking about these academic
positions. Well, I don't think there are professors in. I think that, you know, and this relates to my follow-up, that if we kind of, this isn't just the College of Information Sciences, but, you know, generally this discussion around these issues, we forget what the reason is for having tenure track and tenured lines, which is that the job security is there to protect academic freedom. And so there may be some people who say, well, I don't really care about that. I'm just fine. But the point is that if we're in this profession, we think in terms of teaching, research, and the service that we do, and the kind of public speech that we do, all of which require us to have academic freedom. And that means that we need the freedom to say things that are pushing against the status quo, to say things that are not welcome in the profession, in the discipline, but to try to actually raise questions. And that's what the job security of tenure is for. And simply because people say, I don't want to teach, I just want to do research, or I only want to teach, I don't want to do research, that doesn't take away from the foundational principles of why we have job security and why we should increase that so that everybody has academic freedom. And I don't think it's adequate for people to say, it's not a problem here. Don't worry about it.
No, I think that's absolutely critical. I totally believe that we should have that job security. These research professor lines, which is the ones that I think this really matters in, are people who are not funded through, it doesn't affect the tenure lines, if that's actually in the proposal, right? It will not change the total number of tenure lines to the extent that we can have more tenure lines. That is my job. I will continue to provide more tenure lines. These are separate. These sit, they sit on soft money and they apply for funding separately. So they will not encroach on the growth of the tenure population, which we will continue to grow.
Doug, in Zoom land.
Sure. Doug Anzac, microbiology and immunology. Good to hear your voice again, Charlie, and to see you on screen. I think that my question might have already been answered. But so these research professors would be required to pay their entire salaries from grants. Is that correct?
Yes, or it could be they're part of a center where it's an umbrella sort of thing. But basically, yeah, these are soft money positions.
It's a pretty high bar to set. Most individuals who could pay their own salaries from grants would probably be in a tenure track at most places.
I can comment. Yeah, go on, Ty.
Well, I think there's a whole range of people who approach academics in many different ways. I mean, some people don't want to go through a tenure review. Some people don't want to write papers, but instead they have a lot of knowledge to share from the outside and so on. And we value that kind of knowledge in the POP setting. So I just think that it's not to be corny, but whole greater than the sum of the parts. We have a tremendous teaching research engine here, and we need different types of people. We have retention problems. We have dual career problems. The overall strength of the place depends on being flexible and with moderation, you know, where these percents come in and so on, and these and respect for all these issues. But also, we just have to be more flexible and more different, make possible different kinds of academic careers. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you,
Richard Bensel.
You're muted.
Oh, well, I said, happy to see you. You should come back more. It's good. Several years ago, you presented a big report on tenure track and non-tenure track and RTE and so forth, the numbers. And we haven't seen one since then. But my suspicion is that in these changes, there's been an increase in non-tenure track appointments at Cornell. This one looks particularly dramatic. I mean, looking at your votes, 80% or so of the votes were tenure track, and this looks like it'd be increased. And non-tenure track would be doubled or maybe tripled by this change. But regardless, this is a worry. That, you know, we're basically taking and watering down tenured protected faculty as the core of Cornell University. We've heard over and over again from various departments that they need these non-tenure track appointments for competition with their peers. That may very well be true. It may have been very well be true that in elite universities generally, there's been a decrease in tenure track, and that basically the cost incentives and so forth create these things for a deterioration in the academy. But it is a worry. I'd like to see, this isn't really addressed to you, I'd really like to see Cornell Met make another report and see what the changes have looked like since the last one. Thanks.
Well, I went to institutional planning, has all these dashboards, and you can actually go back and look in time at the stats. Ever since I started paying attention to this, the number of university faculty, that is to say the tenured track faculty, has more or less been in the mid-1500s. That has not changed in 20 years. I don't have a stat on the number of RPs and clinical profs and whatever, but I think it might total about 100, I think.
Charlie, so, I can give those numbers. So I did share with the Senate last May the composition of every college and school, and I gave the percentage of university faculty, research, teaching, and extension faculty for every single college school campus that is inside of the Senate. And the computer science, so the Bauer School of Computing and Information Science, has 80% of their faculty are tenure or tenure track. So they have 3% for research and 16.5% for teaching and no extension. So I think it might be a misunderstanding of what was presented. Those were just how many approved of the resolution, Richard?
Yeah. Right. And I also want to say that, again, that those were just upper bound. And I don't think any, well, we get to mention that maybe OR is close to that. But the fraction is, I'm not alarmed by the fraction or the trends I see there. Yeah.
We have a question or comment from Abby Cohen.
Hi. So I think it's important to put this in context in terms of what we're really comparing this against, which is not the size of the tenure track faculty, but the hiring of adjuncts and other people in very, very marginal employment categories. And in the case of the research professorship, it is really a title. We used to have the titles of senior research associate, senior research associate, and it was just deemed that those titles were not seen to be attractive. At the risk of dating myself, I served on the committee that wrote the enabling legislation. And the logic of it was that these were decisions best made at the college level, that each college could understand and think about what range of titles was important to them. And I've been very pleased over the years to see each and every one of these proposals come forward with a lot of real engagement, thought, and specificity to the specific college that is putting it forward. And I would just like to say, I see this proposal as consistent with all of those others. And whether we like these pressures or we don't like the pressures, these are the realities. And to Cornell's credit, we have continued to have a way, way lower percentage of people in these non-tenure track positions that are truly on very marginal part-time bases. And I think that these titles have helped us maintain that position.
Okay, I think we can move on to the next order of business, which is probably adjournment, but I just want to check with the Dean of Faculty if there are any good of the order scheduled.
We do, Reza, if you want to come up for your good of the order. And thank you, Charlie, also for mentioning. So I think we're going to use our faculty forum for April to discuss RTE faculty. And so that was what Charlie was referring to. So at the end of April, after our Senate meeting, we'll have a faculty forum.
Okay. Thanks, Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. So I'm coming to tell you about a really exciting event that's going to take place next Wednesday, and it's here on the slide for March 15th. And this is an event that's part of an annual series of events that ILR has, and the events are generally called Union Days. We've been doing it for about 35 or so years, and each year we have a theme, and that theme is part of celebrating the labor movement and providing various kinds of events, including panels like this one, keynote speakers, sometimes we have films and directors come, all around a theme that we choose for that year related to the labor movement. And this year, our theme, which isn't on the slide, but the theme is Talk in Union, with, of course, an exclamation point at the end of it. And as you all know, there's been a real uptick in interest generally in the United States and approval ratings for unionization. And we've seen that as well on university campuses, where there's been a lot of organizing of different kinds, collective action, unionizing and collective bargaining, all across the country at different stages. And one of the things that's so interesting about that is that it has affected faculty and graduate student employees, as well as undergraduate student employees. And it's also, we've also seen this in the public sector universities and public universities, as well as in private universities. And so given the interesting organizing activity and activism that's taken place recently, one of the events, in fact, the kickoff event in Union Days this year, is this event of unionizing on university campuses. And so it's a panel. We hope you all come and bring your friends, encourage your students to come. The panel is really interesting. We have speakers who will be speaking about faculty unionizing, about unionizing among graduate student employees. You see from Columbia as well as Northwestern, and undergraduate students who are unionizing there at Dartmouth. And we also have the executive director from the American Association of University Professors, who has had experience in working in all of those areas. So it should be very interesting. And we also have a Zoom option. So it's in 105 Ives Hall, and we also have a Zoom option. And I guess that's it. Let me see if I missed anything. But y'all come. Okay, thanks. And actually, Risa, that reminds me, I forgot to mention, there was a really robust discussion about the global hubs. And so for those of you who want to know more, the Vice Provost of International Affairs has a town hall on Monday the 13th at 11:30, and it's the faculty leads, and they're just discussing, you know, what they do. So I just wanted to put that out there too.
Thank you. Having no more orders of business, we are now adjourned.